Hip politics, baby.
I'm going to count us down in 3, 2, 1. Welcome back to another edition of the Hip Politics podcast. Welcome to all our Hip Politics listeners, fans, family, and friends out across the interwebs. I'm pretty sure everybody, no matter where in the world or where in America you're hearing this right now, you're probably sheltered in place, quarantined. But I hope you're getting through. Prayers up to all those that have been affected or lost loved ones or have people fall ill and fall sick. Please take the shelter in place, stay at home order. Very serious. But quarantine and COVID and Corona are not stopping this show. There's a lot of information. This is still the election 2020, one of the most consequential election seasons of our lifetime. And hip hop has a major part to play no matter what this is going to look like. And so we had to tap into a brother who he didn't realize, but he was one of my early inspirations when I first got into politics on Capitol Hill, and who has had a stellar career. But before we introduce him, I want to give a shout out and say what's up to my co-pilot. This is, again, Mr. Cameron Trimble, a.k.a. Mr. Cameron Calvin, a.k.a. Mr. Hip Politics, a.k.a. Mr. 202. 216 to the 202. And Mike, next week I'm going to break out a new AKA. But and then kicking it over to my co-pilot, Mr. Michael McQuarrie, AKA the mayor of Capitol Hill. Mike, how you doing today? Mr. McQuarrie? Did he freeze? Oh, man. He might have froze. But as we get Mike back, today, our very special guest is Mr. Jamie Harrison. Jamie Harrison is in South Carolina. He is the United States Senate. He's running for United States Senate against their current incumbent, Lindsey Graham. He has an extensive career. Jamie was elected in 2013 as the first African-American chair of the South Carolina Democratic Party. I know Jame, like I said, he was a person who inspired me early in my career when he worked for the majority whip, Congressman Jim Clyburn, who's an institution and one of the most powerful forces and one of the most transformational leaders we've ever had of any race, let alone African-American in Congress, one of the most powerful and influential Congress members. And I saw Jamie as a young man more than a decade ago, kind of working on the floor, working, just kind of building and bringing coalitions, speaking to other staff and really being generous and sharing of his time. And he's now running for Senate. I really hope he wins. Like, the numbers have been looking good and trending upwards. Even in this new digital space with everyone sheltered in place, I've been seeing their ads. I've been seeing his live town halls. So welcome to the Hip Politics podcast, Jamie Harrison.
Thank you, man. Thank you. It's so good to be on with you and Mike, who I've known for most of my adult political life. We kind of cut our teeth on the hill together also. And so it's good to be on with you two brothers.
Good to have you, Jamie.
Thank you, brother.
Well, we want to jump right into it. Jamie, the first kind of question or just basically, like, I mean, especially to be running for Senate, you're very relatively young compared to when you start looking at around the Senate, and it's usually a lot of older white men. We were trying to get a little more diversity in there. But before you got to this point, you're a kid from Orangeburg, South Carolina, correct?
Yeah, man, from Orangeburg, the Berg.
So what got you, what sparked your interest to get into a life and a career of politics?
Well, you know, I think my life in politics really started from just looking at my own life. You know, my family struggled. My mom was a teen when she had me. She was 16. And so my grandparents helped to raise me. And we struggled a lot economically. It was tough times for us. And I remember days when, you know, I'd have to do homework in the dark, or you go outside because we couldn't afford to pay the electric bill, or, You know, I remember eating cereal with water because we couldn't afford a carton of milk. And so, you know, we had tough times, but it seemed like there were leaders out there who were fighting for people and families like mine. I remember one of my very first early memories is it was of Jesse Jackson in the 88 convention. This is a black man from Greenville, South Carolina, who grew up single parent household, very similar story to my own, but he was addressing the nation at this convention. And then you see people like Jim Clyburn, who became the first African-American since Reconstruction to get elected. And I saw these folks in the community, and it just jived well with the lessons I was learning from my grandparents, that you got to work hard, that even though my grandma would always often say that, Jamie, even though you are the least of these, you still have an obligation to the least of these. Mm-hmm. So you have an obligation to the greater community. You would not be where you are if it weren't for a lot of folks sacrificing and doing things for you. And so all of those type of experiences together focused me on how can I make a difference in my community? And that was through politics, through public service. And that's why I'm in this. I want to make sure that little boys and little girls who are growing up in small towns like Orangeburg or in urban areas like Columbia or bigger areas like New York, that they get an opportunity to live the American dream, because I have been able to. I've been able to break out of that cycle of poverty to experience all the great things that this world can provide. But I want to make sure that I'm not some anomaly, that I'm some little, you know, something that people can use as this is that one example out of 10,000. I want to make sure that all 10,000 get that opportunity to do what they want to do and to be as great as they can be. But in order to do that, we got to change the system. In order to change the system, you got to change the leadership. And that's what I'm working on right now.
So, Jamie, tell us about your campaign. I mean, what are you running on? What makes your campaign different from other campaigns out here?
Yeah, man. You know, we're running a campaign on hope. We're running one on hope. Our motto, our state motto here in South Carolina is, while I breathe, I hope. But at the same time,
I hope. I like
while that. I breathe, I hope. But at the same time, you know, I learned in Bible school, faith without works is dead, right? Mm-hmm. So you can't, hope is just not enough. Mm-hmm. Hope is a huge component of it, but there's also some work that has to get done. And what we are doing and what makes our campaign very unique and different than I think any other campaign in the country right now is that we're not only focused on inspiring people, but we're also focused on trying to do the work right now in communities, because people are suffering. People are dealing with issues that they just need help right now. And it's not good enough for me to say, well, y'all just wait until I get elected to U.S. Senate and you wait and see what I do. That's not going to convince folks who have been stuck in the cycle of poverty for generations. And so we have launched a program embedded in my campaign called Harrison Helps. And through Harrison Helps, we go into these neighborhoods, we go into communities, and we partner with community organizations that are already on the ground. And we infuse them with either more resources or with volunteers, because we're trying to help right now and not just after November or just to get people. We're trying to help right now. So the first thing that we did with Harrison Helps, I remember how hard it was, and I'm sure you fellas remember this. You're in school. That first few days of school are so important, particularly to young black folks, because mm-hmm. that's when you can bring out your new shoes, mm-hmm. your new clothes, backpack. I mean, for me, during that time, it was the Trapper Keeper. Like, I wanted that new Trapper Keeper, and I had to have it. But there was one summer in which my mom got laid off of her job, and so she got another job, but she wasn't going to get her first paycheck until after school started. So what that meant was I would start school and not have the new clothes and not new shoes. So I remember going in, it was a Wednesday or Thursday, and then one of your friends come up and go, hey, Jamie, man, are those your new shoes? And I had to say, man, you know, my mom, can't get my stuff until this weekend, but I'm going to have my new stuff next week. And I remember going in the bathroom, and I was real upset. You know, I was emotional, and I cried about it. And I told my staff, I said, the first event I want to do for Harrison Helps is to go back home to Orangeburg and help families like my own who are struggling to get school supplies and all for the kids in their lives. And so that's what we did. We partnered with the Boys and Girls Club. We put on the largest event in the history of the Orangeburg Boys and Girls Club. 700 kids and parents showed up. We raised over $7,000, passed out over 400 backpacks filled with school supplies. And it was just a remarkable thing. I had a mom came up to me and she just thanked me so much, tears rolling down her face. And she said, you know, man, she said, Mr. Harrison, I had no idea how I was going to get these things, but you helped me and I will never forget that. And that is what the role of a U.S. senator or a congressperson, a councilperson is all about, is when your constituents have hardships and problems, that you're going to do all you can to help them address that. And that's what I'm all about on this campaign.
Very good.
Question to that point. A lot of people, I don't think, are as familiar. People just hear the word Congress. I think people in the last several years, the average American or the average person in hip hop kind of knows like, oh, House of Representatives, Senate to an extent. But the Senate, there's only one of your one, you would be one of 100. Every state has two senators. Unfortunately, yep. The District of Columbia does not, where I reside.
We need to change that.
We need to change that, considering we are more populous than seven other states. But I'll get off that soapbox. the significance of you, if you running and you would be winning and being a senator from South Carolina, there's a lot of rich history.
Oh, yeah.
With kind of going back to the Reconstruction era of kind of black U.S. senators. Can you just talk about what the significance of you if being a senator out of South Carolina would be?
Yeah. So currently of the 100, there are three African-American senators right now, Cory Booker, Kamala Harris, and one of our senators here in South Carolina, Tim Scott. And so when I get elected to U.S. Senate, I'll become the fourth African-American senator running. And there are a number of other African-Americans running as well. And I'm hoping those brothers win their races, because that would be a sea change in terms of increasing the percentage of African-Americans that are in the United States Senate, which is, you know, the upper chamber of Congress. And we'll make history here in South Carolina, because we will become the first state in the history of the United States to have two black senators serve at the same time. Tim Scott would become the senior senator in South Carolina, and I would be the junior senator. And this seat that I'm running for has a long history, the storied history, and it's not good. Yes, Lindsey Graham currently occupies it, but before Lindsey Graham, it was Strom Thurmond. And before Strom Thurmond occupied the seat, it was a man by the name of Ben Pitchfork Tillman. He was governor of South Carolina one time, but he also was a U.S. senator. If your listeners Google him, if they're not familiar with Ben Tillman, Google him and you'll see his picture and you'll see and look in the face of Satan himself. This is a guy who would go on the floor of the U.S. Senate and often talk about the joys of lynching of black people. And so, this would be a historic thing, but it would also indicate that we are on the verge of seeing the emergence of what I call the New South, a New South that is rising, that Stacey Abrams was able to almost tap into. But I think in this election cycle, we'll break that ceiling. You got Reverend Warnock, who's running in Georgia for the United States Senate. Former Secretary Mike Espy, who's running in
Mississippi.
You got Royce West, who there's a primary out in Texas, but Royce West, who's a state senator there, is also running to vie for the Senate race in Texas. You got a young brother in Kentucky who is also running in the primary as well. I mean, it's going to be a hard to break through there. But you got an opportunity where there's a lot of African Americans running for the U.S. Senate. But what we are trying to do is to demonstrate that the old myths that black folks can't raise money, you can't build this coalition, you can't do that. Man, we've been breaking through every single one of them. They put a barrier in front of me, and I, with a smile on my face, I have a joy of pushing right through it. because my entire life people have told me that you can't do certain things. I remember they told me you can't go to college. Well, I went to Yale. You can't go to law school. I did that. You can't be a top staffer on Capitol Hill. I did that too. And now they're telling me I can't win the United States Senate. And I'm saying,
you're going to do that. And you're going to do that.
Exactly right.
Yeah.
Exactly right.
Two things. One, there's a Robert Smalls.
Yeah.
Senator Robert Smalls, who during Reconstruction, after slavery, he was a senator. He was an African-American U.S. senator and businessman from South Carolina. And there's a statue.
Congressman Robert Smalls.
Congressman Robert Smalls.
Yeah. And I hope one day somebody does a movie on him. You talk about an amazing story. That is one that needs to be up on the silver screen.
Yeah, it definitely. And I learned a lot about him because there's a kind of a bust and a little piece to him in the National Museum of African American History and Culture, where I used to work for years. And so, but it's right there on the corner on the one of the floors, and you walk by it, and he's just kind of a very distinguished looking man. And just I just remember reading over that so many different times and kind of just diving into his life. And to your point, yes, like his entire life, his serving both after and during could make it to the silver screen.
Yep.
One thing you mentioned that I wanted to kind of understand now, we are all as a world, not just as a country, but as a world amidst this coronavirus outbreak, this COVID-19 illness that it can cause. All these massive pressures on our healthcare system, our financial system, the economy, so many people out of work or struggling, like massive different things have changed. But one thing has also changed, again, this is being an election year. This is also a census year. So much of elections are going out and touching the people, going out, meeting people where they are, going into their communities, going into their houses of faith, going into their actual houses, knocking door to doors, getting your volunteers and your teams organized, getting people organized at your campaign headquarters, phone banking, all these different things, in addition to the online digital strategy through social media, email, and then phones. But now you can't do any of these like physical activations. And honestly, we don't even know how long this is. I mean, we're talking a minimum of a month or two. And then also there's just that social psychological aspect of when do people, even if we're kind of through the best of it and the curve is flattened, are people actually still mentally engaged and like ready to be able around groups of people or having strangers kind of knock on their doors? How have you adjusted and kind of shifted your strategy or shifted your outreach amid this now that we're in a shelter in place? Most states are either on some level of a quarantine, shelter in place, stay at home order, or even if your states don't have it, people just are naturally kind of doing that. So how have you shifted to a more digital, I guess, non-in-person kind of campaign?
Yeah. Well, the first thing, even before I get into that, one thing I want to tell folks, particularly in the African-American community, folks, if you can, stay at home.
Mm-hmm.
If you see the statistics that are coming out right now in some of these cities, they're heartbreaking because the deaths are disproportionately African American. And mm-hmm. so I know early on folks thought the increased melanin had some kind of superpower of invincibility or something like that. But folks, this is a deadly, deadly virus. Stay at home. Limit your interactions with people outside of your immediate family because, again, we don't know a whole lot about this virus. And what we know right now is it's killing people. Mm-hmm. And so it's important for people to stay at home, wash your hands, wear your mask if you have to go out, and just be cautious and safe. For us on the campaign, we had to adjust. We were probably one of the very first Senate races in the country to pull down our events because we had just launched a 46 county Restoring Hope tour in South Carolina where we were going to visit all of the counties in the state.
Oh, wow.
And visit communities where people typically have not been going. I was in Allendale County, one of the last visits we had. Woman told me, she said, Lindsey Graham's been a senator for almost 18 years here in South Carolina, and I have never seen him in Allendale. She said, I've lived here my entire life. She was probably about 80 years old and never seen him in Allendale County. So we were going into the communities in the areas where people have not traditionally been to, because we believe that it's very important to go into those communities to ask for their votes. Mm-hmm. But now we're sort of limited, right? Because we have to do this online. And so what we've been doing is we've been doing town hall meetings. Every week we do a town hall. And I've interjected, you know, I'll go on Instagram Live or Instagram or go live. I was on with Charlamagne this past week.
Yeah, I saw that. That was good.
Yep. And we're trying to mix it up and do a lot of different things. But at the same time, we realize that we are not going to reach everybody in South Carolina that way. And partly that's because of the situation here. Third of the state doesn't have access to broadband.
Wow.
So that means it's going to be very difficult to meet some of, particularly our older voters, to meet them in a virtual sense. And so our hope is to go up on TV soon, to do radio, black radio, which is important. We're working with our black newspapers to make sure that we get a message out that way. And that's the best approach at this point to meeting people. We have to go to where they are. And we have to figure out. So I got a radio interview on Saturday with a gospel radio station, because again, that's really important to do as well. So we're going to do all that we can virtually and through the online and all. But at the same time, we got to figure out other mediums to connect with voters.
Exactly, Jamie. Real quick, when your time on the Hill, what did that teach you about your campaigning now? Your time when you worked on the Hill.
Man, you know, it was so good. I actually wrote a book about it. We learned so much about public service. And the one thing I learned, it was, I guess I probably didn't learn it on the Hill, but the Hill reinforced it, is that you treat all people the same, right? It doesn't matter if they're the janitor or they're the speaker of the house. Right. And that's something my grandma would always tell me. She said, Jamie, the people that you see on your way up are also the same people you see on your way down. And the way they treat you is the way that you have treated them on that up and down process that we have in life. And so I used to make sure that I took the time out to mentor folks, to talk to people, to take care of folks. So you remember when I was the floor leader, we would have late night votes. And so part of the late night votes is I got to make sure we feed the members of Congress who are there voting late.
Right.
So when we did that, I would also order additional food, not only for the members of Congress, but for the staffs that are sitting there. Yes, that's what I'm talking about. The Capitol Hill police that were there, the staff that worked off the floor. Mm-hmm. And I would tell them, you come, you know, we ordered this from Miwa tonight, you know, and why don't you come and, you know, members come at this time. And after the members are done, you can come and get your plate, whatever. And people appreciate that almost to the extent where that when I left Capitol Hill and I would go on the Hill just to go visit Mr. Clyburn or go to the office, the Capitol Police would see me standing in long lines, and they look back and be like, Jamie, is that you? I was like, hey, yeah, how are y'all doing? It's like, that man's like, you wouldn't be standing in the line. Well, come on, come. But, you know, it was – that's something that they could give me because they were so appreciative of what I used to give to them. Right. And that's something really, really important that I think all of us can't get caught up in these titles and all these other things. We just got to treat people the way that we want to be treated. And if we do that, the world will be such a better place. And so that's something that lives with me to this day. It was something taught to me by my grandparents, reinforced by Jim Clyburn and my experiences, not only on the Hill, but in life in general.
I just want to say it was always when I would see you on the floor, I would smile knowing that you were on the floor and that I knew you at that time, because people don't understand how hard it is sometimes just to break through up there on the Hill. And I tell people, sometimes it's not what you know, it's who you know.
Amen.
You know how to, you know, navigate the Hill. And you were one of the people that taught me how to navigate the Hill.
Well, and you know what's so important, and this, people critique members of the Congressional Black Caucus all the time, but they don't understand us. If not for the members of the Black Caucus, then there probably would not be very many Black staffers on Capitol Hill.
Amen.
Jim Clyburn gave me the opportunity, and I remember when this happened. Mm-hmm. I was standing probably about 6 feet from Clyburn as he was talking to another member of Congress, and he had just become chair of the House Democratic Caucus. Mm-hmm. And somebody said, "Well, Jim, who are you going to have as a staffer to run the caucus?" Now, I was 29 at the time. Clyburn said, and he looked over and pointed at me, he said, "Jamie Harrison." And the member kind of turned their back to me, and I could still hear them. And they said, "Well, you know, Jim, he's kind of young. You know, there are a lot of seasoned staffers here you could probably get from Pelosi's office or Hoyer's office in order to help with that." And Clyburn said, "No." He said, "Jamie Harrison is smart. Yes, he's young, but he's experienced, and he's loyal, mm-hmm. and he's going to be my guy." And that was a real big moment for me because it said to me that Jim Clyburn had my back and understood that in order to have folks that look like us mm-hmm. in leadership, you have to groom people like us so that we can get the experience and that we can train a whole new generation of folks to come behind us. Right. So I was the first black person to be a floor director on the House in the history of the House. I was the first black executive director of the House Democratic Caucus. The caucus is one of the oldest institutions in the House of Representatives, 200 plus years. And it wasn't until 2006, when I became the ED, was the first black person to do that. And that was all because of Jim Clyburn. Mm-hmm. You know, all of these other Democrats in the past didn't do that, mm-hmm. but it was Jim Clyburn, a member of the CBC, who saw that it was an important thing to do, and so therefore he did it. And so that's why I'm always appreciative of the members of the CBC, and people don't give them enough due and credit for how hard they fight to make sure that we have a piece of the pie and that we're not the only ones in the room.
So do you know the name of that member that was talking to Mr. Clyburn that said that?
No, I can't remember.
okay.
Yeah.
Jamie, I know you got to get going. We just wanted to wrap up. We wrap up all of our Hip Politics podcast interview. It's a tradition kind of from barbershops and debates as old as hip hop. It's so much so that even Chris Rock made a movie about it. Top five. We call it. Top five dead or alive. So that's like whether they're current living or even those have gone on. Top five favorite hip hop artists or artists of all time.
Well, and I would say
I know you have a robust listening, so even if they're not hip hop influenced, perhaps.
Well, you know, listen, you know, I grew up with my grandparents, and you know, in the 80s and the 90s, my grandma was not going to have that type of music up in her house if it wasn't like Shirley Caesar or something, you know, something to that extent. So when I listened to hip hop, it was mostly when I went over to friends' houses. Mm-hmm. Or at, you know, at the dances at school or something like that. But I would say these are the ones that to this day, like when I hear it, it moves me, right? So, of course, Biggie and Pac are like, you know, if not in your top five, I just don't know, right? I would also say, I would not say these were in the top five of the greatest, but top five that I love to hear. I love Salt and Pepper. Mm-hmm. To this day.
Of course. Okay.
I absolutely love Salt and Pepper. The Fugees were, when they came on board, it was just like something new, right? It was just like, it was taking that old soul, but also putting a new flair to it. So mm-hmm. I would add them to it. And who's turning 50? I put Jay-Z. So there you go. Five that I love. Again, I would not
say solid five. That's a solid five.
Yeah, that's good.
Yeah. So, Pop, Biggie, the Fugees, Salt and Pepper, and Jay-Z. That's a strong five. I give you that.
Okay.
If you had any closing words, we wanted to say thank you again.
Yeah, listen, I would love for folks to go to jamieharrison.com, my website. If you live in South Carolina, or if you're not even in South Carolina, but you want to see a change in leadership in our U.S. Senate, go to jamieharrison.com. And I spell Jamie a little differently, y'all. It's J-A-I-M-E, jamieharrison.com. Find out information about how to volunteer, you send a donation, or any other way you can help. You got friends and family in South Carolina, have them make sure that they register that they're educated about voting and make sure they take their behinds to the polls and vote.
Amen.
That's so, so key and so important. But I want to thank y'all for allowing me to be on today.
No, thank you. It means so much. Again, like I said, you inspired me without even knowing it. When I first got there, you worked with Mike so much and been just very helpful. And you are really a shining example to so many people, especially just at least for our platform, so many people in the hip hop generation of that. Look what I can do coming from where you've come from to where you're going, and just how much and really appreciate all the work, all the work and efforts and everything that you've done. So again, thank you. We have Jamie Harrison, candidate for U.S. Senate. Please go out and support this brother.
Hello, Jamie.
Thank you, brothers. Appreciate y'all.
You have another, and this has been another edition of the Hip Politics Podcast. And thank you. Make sure you check us out on all platforms, hippolitics.org, hippoliticspodcast.com. And with that, we're out. Peace.
Peace, everybody.
Hip Politics, baby.